It's about that time.
Yep.
It's kinetic time. And
yes.
So the topic of today is genetics of Kemet or Egypt. You know, one and the same. And what do we know about it? The genetics in relation to Egypt. I'm going to break that down in more ways than one.
Exactly. It's a lot of nuances, a lot of little details, you know, like a lot of trickery and shit with it, but, you know, now it's time to, you know, kind of break that shit down. And, you know, make sense of it.
Absolutely.
You know? A lot of people don't know what the fuck is going on. So, you know, a lot of people really don't.
Of course.
A lot of people, like, they, you know, go on these little forums and shit, and they think they know what it is, and they don't. So, it's like there's a lot of confusion and shit.
My gosh. Wait, hold on. Calm down with the language. We know we're putting this on YouTube later.
I forgot. But yeah,
this is straight facts.
So,
I'm going to get into it. All right, so when we're talking about the genetics of Kemet, it's a piece of the puzzle, 0.1%. It is a piece of the puzzle, and I think it's a very important piece of the puzzle as well.
Right. It's, but the thing is, though, like, it's like people keep trying to make it, like, the main piece, and it's not, you know. It's like it's other shit.
Well, it's hard to really say what's the main piece, you know? Is it a main piece? Maybe it is, maybe it's not, I don't know. But I just know that a lot of these things are just one component of a complete puzzle. So, yeah, I want to first start off, well... where do we want to start off? It's a couple of things we want to break down. I identified a couple of things, such as Soikita's study, Hawass's study, Diop, DNA tribes. Or did you want to start off with something that you...
So, one thing I think we should do, because we should put everything in like chronological order, as far as like when did...
Go ahead.
Like, when this shit happened, like, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
what studies is oldest and shit, and, you know, which ones is newest and all that. But to my knowledge, as far as Nile Valley civilization is concerned, the oldest study was done by a guy named Professor Hassan, and it was by the University of Khartoum. It was the A group Nubians. And what they found was that these people were, like, it's almost... Almost entirely Nilotic. Like, they didn't do autosoma, but they did haplogroups. And what they found was that it was almost exclusively haplogroup A, which characterizes Nilotic populations. So that, and they also said that haplogroup A preceded what would come later, which was haplogroup E and whatnot. So that being said, it's kind of... you know, it's kind of evidence of a Nilotic base in the population early on, and a continuance of different populations kind of settling in the region and whatnot. So,
and then, Billy, did you had you have any relation or study relation to that early study?
Oh, I'm sorry. What study are you referring to? I didn't catch that.
It was a study done by the University of Khartoum in 2008. I'm posting in the Jumbotron right now.
Mm-hmm. And when you said A, you're talking about Nubia group A?
Yeah, A group Nubians. Yeah. So this is, you know, pre-dynastic. So, you know, some of the first pastoralists to go into the Nile Valley from the Sahara Desert. So that's what we got right there. And... nobody really, the thing I noticed is this study really went under the radar. This was literally, to my knowledge, the first ADNA test on ancient Nile Valley remains. And I've never seen anybody even reference this study except for maybe like three or four people. It's just swept under the rug. And the implication of it is.
That's cool. I haven't heard of that study, but I think we should just start citing the 2017 study.
You talking about Abusir?
Yeah, I think we should just start citing it because all these people are citing it and they haven't read it.
Right.
Well, the thing is about that.
Absolutely. We can touch on it, little nuggets here and there, but I think Trey wants to really break that down in a future discussion because
it gets its own topic.
It's going to get its own topic. Yep. Right, it's that important.
Yep, it gets its own topic because that is the fallback for every group that says that, you know, the Egyptians were not black. That is their answer. So let's assess that answer.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is that, like, the fact that people have made it so important and the media has pushed it sort of proves that, you know, the study is an exception.
Yeah.
Right? Because if it wasn't an exception, it wouldn't be used as much. They would be using, you know, all these other sort of genetic studies. And there are dozens of genetic studies on ancient Egypt. And none of them have gotten anywhere near the attention that this one study has. I'm wondering why that would be the case. But, yeah, like, there's studies on modern Egyptian populations, like Upper Egyptians. This is a study... I'm trying to look at the name of the study. Just give me a second, because I have the...
You're talking about the Gurna study from 2004?
The Gurna study, correct, yes. And they found that their haplotypes, the frequencies of their haplogroups were similar to that of Ethiopians, right? So the frequency of, for example, like some M1 haplogroups. But they found that their haplogroups had mutations that you don't find in other Northeast or East African populations, so that they are themselves, right, descendants of some East African population that was unique. And they've sort of kept this component. And so, like, things like that just don't get attention.
I think one thing we should do is kind of like talk about the relevance of genetic studies as far as linking modern Egyptians and ancient Egyptians. I think that's a misnomer. I think that's the number one misnomer in genetics, right? As far as all this ADNA shit, there's this vague assumption that today's that we can study populations in regions today and assume that the people in those regions today were the same as the people in the regions, you know, thousands of years ago. And we say, okay, we're going to test this population and we're going to see what was in the ancient population. I mean, that is so asinine because it's just based on just assumptions, just. Assumptions.
Well, what are the assumptions? I don't understand. Like, you, if you look at DNA studies of modern Egyptians, all of them show that they're heavily admixed, right? And many of them show, I think the majority of them that, you know, talk about this admixture, you know, have a date for this admixture. And it's around the midpoint being around the 14th century. There are people who try to cast doubt about the capabilities of linkage disequilibrium, right? And this is literally like cutting edge scientific technology. Things like Alder, Malder. When you talk about F3 statistics, these people believe in genetics, but not when the genetics leads them to places that they don't like. And then all of a sudden they talk about standards of error, right? And things of the sort. Actually, they don't talk about standards of errors. They just say things are wrong, which is not that's not a concept in science, right? If I want to measure FBA tray's height, right? Let's say I have some sort of program that uses people's shoe size to measure their height. Okay, you actually can do that. You actually can do that. The thing is that your little regression is not going to be perfect. And so there's going to be a lot of people who fall outside of the expectation values. That's fine. What you do is you have a margin of error. And so FBA Trey, yeah, I might not get his exact height, but given his shoe size, I likely will be able to estimate what his height is with a margin of error. I can give a probability of what his height is. And so they just say, oh, this is wrong, because you're not speaking to scientific people. And I think that we just have to sort of treat children like children are, right? Like, okay, this is a kid we're speaking to. Like, they're not ready to have an adult conversation about genetics. So just to dismiss it. I would not sort of try to take and characterize any of these arguments that these people are making as relevant. They're not.
Well, I think you touched on something, Bodhi. And when we're talking about this admixture, I want people to realize that, yeah, this admixture was mostly during the impact around the first millennium BC. And that is corroborated with the language impact as well. UNESCO has explicitly talked about that. Something I do want you to touch on, Bodhi, is the fact about if you could look up your research that you did on Hawass's DNA study. I think that'll be great to break down. Also, UNESCO, or according to Hawass, he says that there hasn't been any type of genetic study done just yet. He told that to UNESCO in 2017. We know that's false, but he does admit that the skull looks African.
The skull on who?
The skulls that have been exhumed and examined. He is at least admitted that the skulls look African from what he has examined.
Yeah, the skulls from what site in Egypt and what time period in Egypt is my question.
Yeah, he didn't say particularly what period.
Of course he wouldn't. Of course he wouldn't. Yeah, I mean, anything that sort of connects Egypt to Africa is going to be, when I say connected to Africa, it's an insane statement because it's a place in Africa, but I'm not kidding. It's low energy, low effort there. There's not an eagerness, to sort of admit these things, right? You still have people sort of arguing whether the ancient Egyptians were dark skinned. We know for a fact that these were dark skinned people, but they're hesitant to say that. I mean, Stuart Tyson Smith has an article about this, you know, because of racial attitudes that still continue today. And there's this, overzealousness, right, on the part of people who want to strip the civilization from its blackness, right, or its Africanness or its indigeneity to the continent of Africa, to try to misrepresent genetic data and studies. And that's why FBA Trey is skeptical. But when you actually look at the genetic data and studies, often it does not comport with even the reality that they want. The 2017 Abusir study is an example of that. But also there was a study in Lebanon, right, where they found, quote unquote, Lebanese Egyptians. And a lot of people have cited that study. You look at the Wikipedia for that study. I edited it, by the way. But the study itself, you know, connects this, quote unquote, Lebanese Egyptian, right, this Egyptian person who migrated to Lebanon, to other Africans such as Yoruba. Right. The study name is A Genetic History of the Near East from ADNA Time Course Sampling, 8 points in the past 4,000 years. Very cool. You can see in the diagrams. I even emailed the professor. Hey, this sample is closer to, you know, Africans and Egyptians. It does not say that it is closer to people from the Levant. Let me find the exact quote.
Yeah, I've seen you post that a couple of weeks ago, and it said that these people had relationships with Yoruba too, right?
Yeah, not necessarily relationships. It's just that they shared genomes with Egyptians. One of the individuals was thought to be just Egyptian, and then they had a child with someone who was Lebanese and Egyptian, and so that's why that child had 30-something% DNA associated to the Levant, and then 60% of their DNA related to Egypt. So it was a mother-child relationship. And I think they established that through their mtDNA. Just a second.
And make sure you can reference that Hawass study, too. I think that'll be a great point of reference, too, once you find it. While we're waiting on Bodhi for that, I wanted to, let's just make my reference point. Since I already talked about UNESCO, I'll just continue with UNESCO for now. UNESCO didn't do a lot of DNA, like I said, when it comes to who the Egyptians were, but Antediop did do, he did find in some study that the blood groups were related. It is notable fact that even today, Egyptians, particularly in Upper Egypt, belong to the same group B as the populations of Western Africa on the Atlantic seaboard and not to A2 group characteristic of a white race prior to any crossbreeding. It would be interesting to study that the extent of group A distribution in Egyptian mummies, which present-day techniques can make possible. We also know that Anta Diop also did a melanin dosage test. And that dosage test also came out. I don't need to really break that down, but the fact that the melanin was exuberant, it was in high affinity to be of darker skinned people. Trey, is that correct?
Yep. That was a study in from Germany. I know it was a study from Germany that took the Diop melanin dosage test and validated those that method and found that some Upper Egyptian, I think 12th Dynasty nobles, you know, they were, of course, quote unquote, packed with melanin. So, anybody say anything different is, you know, they're just trolling.
No, there shouldn't be an argument about whether these people were dark skinned. We know that they're dark skinned. I mean, that's not. It wouldn't even make sense to ask that question. But this is the exact what I was looking for in this study. The two Hellenistic individuals and one early Roman individual showed excess haplotype sharing with Central and South Asian populations compared with that of other ancient Lebanese individuals, whereas individuals SFI 43 and SFI 44 shared more segments with Africans and Egyptians. This study's not arguing that these people came from the Congo and they jumped out of the Congo, but you can't use this study to argue, hey, this population was Levantine. And the name of the study again is mitochondrial DNA sequence diversity. Oh no, I'm sorry, that's the wrong one. It is called A Genetic History of the Near East from ADNA Time Course Sampling 8 Points in the Past by Mark Haber. And then the previous study I cited about the Gurna is called Mitochondrial DNA Sequence Diversity in a Sedentary Population from Egypt. But yeah, like people just abuse these studies. Like they always say, oh, the Abusir study shows that they were not African at all. No, actually, that is not the claim of the Abusir study. And the Abusir study itself sort of contradicts that. But I know I'm not supposed to go into that because apparently we can't discuss it. But I will read. I'm looking for it. But anyways, the study says, clearly more genetic studies on ancient human remains from southern Egypt and Sudan are needed before apodictic statements can be made. You know, and they say, no, you can look at the south and it could be very much different. But somehow that nuance, the nuances of all these genetic papers somehow get lost, right? And people can parade around and talk about how King Tut was R1B and that makes them Western European. But when, Noam Nott, right, and his brother get tested as M1A1, we don't like wave that flag around. And so I think we need more Afrocentrists or whatever you want to call them, Hoteps, who just basically do the same thing on a childish level. So like people can see how stupid this is to be like, oh, I have a sample and it says this, right? I'm gonna argue the ancient Egyptians all came from modern day Liberia because Ramesses III was E1B1A. Why not? Absolutely. Why shouldn't we?
I mean, in relation to that, Trey, what did you wanted to also bring to the table? I know you this is much more around your rodeo.
I just look at, the current state of, where we are with this whole discussion on Egypt and, what it's kind of turned into. It's just, like I said, it's just basically been turned into all, genetics. And again, the thing that somebody noted, I think it was, I saw Imhotep earlier this year. He said, there was up until, at this moment, there are still less than a dozen studies or a dozen specimens that have been, fully sequenced, but for some reason, one thing we're seeing is, despite that almost complete lack of, evidence to really make a summary, we see people kind of rushing to, make this narrative, that, oh, well, we have genetics. Oh, we know everything now. And it's just getting goofy at this point. It's like, you know, we don't have, it's like we don't have any other pieces of information to answer this question, you know. It's like it's almost entirely, oh, my bad. No, it's almost entirely, you know, based on genetics. And I mean, I just, it's still a baby. That's what I'm saying. And the information we get from it, I'm not sure what study has actually been useful at this point as far as actually answering the question. I mean, every study just seems to, there have been really no studies that really kind of back each other. You know, it's like every day, every month, there's something new. You know, it's a new conclusion. It's this, it's that. And it's just like, we are going in every fucking corner, every direction, every 6 or 7 months, because nothing's consistent. Nothing. So it's just like, I mean, you know, how valuable is this information really answering this question? It's just, I mean, it's really just making you ask more questions, you know? And I mean, nothing's really consistent from what I see. What's up, Ashton?
And hold on. And just for anybody else coming into the room, I don't mind Aston speaking because I already know how thorough he is on this subject matter. But for now, no one else is going to be speaking, at least during this portion. Once we stop this portion of the discussion, we'll be having speakers come on and they can speak to the subject matter. But go ahead, Aston.
You know, I was just going to say one thing. Maybe it's not a bad thing that it's not spitting out one answer, because, you know, the people that you're talking about have like all these multiple lines of ancestry, so like all these different groups. And so maybe it should be like answers that go every which way. But with that aside, with DNA, there's a real big thing about sampling bias. And just to give the perfect example, the Abu Sir study, I know we don't really want to talk about it, but it said the mummies were 6 to 15% African, depending on which model you use, right? So if you use this model, then they're 6% African. But if you include these other Africans, then, okay, they have this much and this much, so it's 15% African. Like, what do you think is going to be if you use pygmies? They're going to be like 0% African. And a study just came out, Lazaridis. You can go to his Twitter, and like, they didn't use East Africans, they didn't use Yoruba, they didn't even use pygmies. They went all the way to Khoisan to model the ancestry in these Eurasians, like Khoisan.
That's what I mean. No, I mean,
and they didn't pick any Khoisan. They picked Juhuan North, which is like the most divergent population on the planet. It would be like using people from Papua New Guinea to say, okay, this is the real Eurasian, and all y'all other people are somehow mixed. And if you ran it like that, oh yeah, they're going to come up mixed. They're going to come up very mixed, because Papans are very divergent Eurasians. And so, like, these people, they playing games. They playing games, and we getting played. I just wanted to put that out there.
I think I read in Keita's response, they didn't even use East Africans as reference, did they?
They didn't in that. Okay. They didn't in that, but this new one, yo, they skipped over pygmies and went all the way to the furthest population. And, like, we know what that's going to do.
And what's the name of this study?
It's a new one that just came out. I'll put it in Jumbotron.
Thank you.
That's what I mean. You know, I mean, that's the problem I have with just this hindrance on genetics. It's like, I mean, when they do shit like that, like they use, I mean, it's all based on relative populations. You know, what is the reference population in a database for sub-Saharan Africans? Do you got one or do you got 50? You know, if you hit 50, I guarantee you have a lot more matches with Africans. But, you know, you choose one here, one there. I mean, it's just stupid at this point. I mean, because it's not, if they were serious by now, they would have had every damn African tribe in Africa. They would have had that in the database. They would have had all of them in the database if they were serious. You know, they would have had that. You know, they would go to Upper Egypt. They would excavate, you know, pre-dynastic to, you know, old early kingdom remains, and, you know, just go from there. But they're playing games. That's what I'm saying. I mean, you go to a fucking Hicks, my bad. You go to a Hickso grave talking about, you know what, these are the Egyptians. I mean, just stuff like that. It's just like, how can anybody take these people seriously? I mean, and then, you know, the clapback that nobody talks about is Kata did his own analysis of, you know, the Abu Sir study, for example. Well, not Abu Sir, but, you know, of the Amarna period's remains. And, you know, what he found was, you know, the conclusion that Abu Sir made that, well, sub-Saharan DNA did not come into Egypt until the Islamic slave trade. Well, no, that's debunked. That's debunked. We have affinities in two pharaonic dynasties, the Ramesside dynasty and the Amarna period dynasty. So, you know, but I mean, it's just, like I said, I think it's just a game. I think it's a game. And I think until we get resources and we can conduct our own studies, then that we're just at their mercy. And I don't like
it's a game and they winning. It's a game and they winning.
I don't even call it winning because, I mean, if you haven't debated. If you ever debated these people, they don't win. They're stupid.
But they,
you know, they'll reference Abu Sir. A modern Egyptian will reference Abu Sir like that's something that helps them in their whole argument of continuity. It's like, I mean, it's stupid.
I mean, I'm saying they win in academia because they're playing us. We're not playing them. They're playing us. They hold the cards. They got the power. They have access to the samples. They're the ones going to run the mummy and use Juwan North or Pygmy as the African reference. So that's why they went in.
Yeah, man. And our media is extremely just so happy for some reason to push into that and play into that. I don't think they'll ever stop. Like, they did the same thing with King Tut, where all of a sudden, someone from the 18th dynasty of Egypt is Western European. That is a claim that, you know, National Geographic even wrote about. And then you have the Abu Sir study, which is just, you know, taken as the word of God, even though the Abu Sir study says that Levantine and some types of European Anatolians, right, are closer to the ancient Egyptians than modern Egyptians. Somehow that's not offensive. You know, somehow that's not problematic, but...
I think we need to look deeper into what's going on with these people and why they do this.
Well, hold on.
There's something...
I feel like we having a long discussion around the Abu Sir thing, which we're going to really touch on much later, like you requested, right? But I do want you to... I know you are thorough enough on also genetically when it comes to King Tut and his... And it goes back to, I think, isn't this akin to Hawassa's study, King Tut having sickle cell disease?
Yeah, I saw that as well. So he has sickle cell. I think that, I mean, you know, sickle cell having a single African origin, you know, I mean, you only... you know, get that from other Africans, but, you know, having sickle cell in itself doesn't prove your race. You know, we see that in Greece and whatnot, but again, the fact that it's in Africa, it's found in not just Tut, but pre-dynastic Upper Egyptians. I think that's, I think that is significant in indicating, you know, what type of African, you know, has some sort of, you know, role in people in ancient Egypt, you know,
But I think it is important to note that they do say it the probability. When we're talking about science, we are talking about a higher percentage of probability. And they make note of that probability being at birth as to life expectancy more than 5 years. And the fact that it is much more, I guess, conditioned to the African diaspora. Could that be correct or not correct?
Can you say that last part again?
The greater probability being that it would be much more akin to an African or a Black person with that affinity to being having sickle cell anemia. Could that be? Is that more likely to be true or not true, as far as probability?
Yeah. It's more likely to be true. that that person has, you know, recent West African or so-called Niger-Congo ancestry.
And I know y'all had a little bit of a debate about this earlier. Is it, so the probability would be much more higher to be an African, but what's the lower, do we know the lower probability of that being someone else?
I think it would be a lower probability of non-black people having those traits.
The dissertation. Guys, so when I'm talking about this, mine is more so catered to dissertations. It's not a whole lot of dissertations as far as genetics in Egypt that I could find. But the funny thing is that the one person who speaks about it a lot is Soy Keita. So I will be referencing him a lot. He has an issue, apparently, with the notion of like a mixed population, apparently. I'm going to read a little bit of it. The Negroid grouping in the Saharan Nilotic-Sudanic triangle has ranged from extremely short, pygmy tribes to slender to 7-foot-tall groups, with a ranging of hair types of the latter Caucasoid. Similar variability occurs in Europe populations with a general longer head-shaped Scandinavian Mediterranean populations, shorter ones seen in Central and Eastern Europeans, and yet it will be difficult to use such variation to biologically justify a rigid racial taxonomy for these European peoples. They are generally seen as simply variants within a larger European population. In Northwest Africa, however, standards are applied differently according to the mainstream scholars. Some older historians assert a third race, a more specific reexamination of the early Nile Valley population, such as the Badari, show several affinities within a range of tropical African types. Now, when we're talking about these several African types, they range from what I've seen, West Asia and even Southwest, and of course East Africa as well.
But yeah, when we talk about, you know, the physical attributes of the Egyptians, you know, not genetic, you know, we know that they're African. We know that they're African, you know, but when we talk about, you know, we talk about, for example, the Badarians, you know, those were Negroid people, you know, typically found to be so from a physiological standpoint, but genetically they have not been tested. They're a key group in the formation of Egypt, being, you know, the first farmers on the Nile Valley from the Sahara. But, you know, to this day, they've not been tested. You know, when we talk about these cranial studies, the Badarian and the Nakata period Egyptians are the ones that are most often, you know, just the center of a study. You know, they're the topic. And, you know, we don't see any of these people being, sequenced, or at least, you know, the actual data being released. You know, we just see them kind of tiptoeing around that. And it's just trolling to me, you know, and it's just, you know, it's just trolling. You know, who knows how many decades we'll have to wait for that study. You know, and I mean, that's like the most basic study you can make about the Egyptians as far as genetically. I mean, if you're seriously trying to answer that question, it's the most basic thing you can do. But 12 years in the ADNA, 14 years in the ADNA, and, you know, still nothing, you know. So, like I said, it's a game. It's all a game.
Absolutely. One other thing, Soy Keita kind of, talked about, he was talking about the peopling of, the Egyptian Nile Valley. I'll sum it up in a little bit. The major, variability of the early Egyptians is thus seen to have been mainly established in the proto-dynastic, period where people were settling. No ongoing major mass movements of new groups into the Nile Valley are postulated between the early dynastic and the latest dynastic period, with the possible exception of the Asiatic Hyksos. Internal movements did occur. Given all the data, these explanations of variability is temporal origin are more plausible with Smith's migration theories, which sees that the presence of Egyptians with Negroid phenotypes as being the result of slavery during dynastic times. The people with the various described phenotypes that were united very early by developing common culture. By the time of the unification, they were all indigenous and primarily of African origin. No major migrations need to be invoked in most cases in dynastic times. And to explain variation, the next migrations of probable major genetic impact were during the late dynastic periods and beyond, after Assyrian, Persian, Greek, and Roman ascension. That is Soikido.
Right. I mean,
I think,
you know,
Soikido is even, if you read that, he's even in corroboration again with UNESCO, which is not surprising to me. Again, even Bodhi said earlier, around the 1400 century late, millennium, first millennium BC is where we see this major impact, if at all. And that's not to say that there might have been small ones in between. They would have been readily absorbed. And again, when we're talking about the Hyksos, which he has only talked about being the first major impact of an outside genetic influence, we got to remember that the Hyksos only primarily stayed in the Delta and in Lower Egypt. So they didn't have much of an impact when we're talking about Upper Egypt, where we find most of the iconography, archaeological reliefs, and what have yous.
Right. Again, you know, we know this. We know that these Northern Egyptians, particularly, you know, later on, they were inconsequential to, you know, the formation or the maintenance of the civilization. And we see that, you know, multiple, you know, lines of evidence show that there is a differentiation between these earlier, you know, early Southern Egyptians, you know, because that's where the majority of Egyptian population lived at. And these later, so-called, modern Egyptians, you know, there's a complete distinction, physically. Now, some people, you know, I'm willing to argue that, you know, if they actually did the genetic test right, you know, you will find the exact same pattern genetically. You will find the exact same pattern, but that's why I look at it with the evidence.
And then Keita also makes reference that the Upper Egyptian population apparently began to converge skeletally on Lower Egyptian patterns through the dynastic epoch. Whether this is primarily due to genetic flow or other factors has yet to be finally determined, but the Lower Egyptian pattern is intermediate to that of various Northern Europeans and West African and Khoisan series.
I have my own conjecture on Northern Egyptians. Mentioned, and I'm posting the Jumbotron, that another group that's intermediate between West Africans and some other African groups that's not really quote unquote African are the so-called Indian or Dravidian populations.
Mm-hmm.
And Keita mentioned that in his 1992 study. He did like an entire 2 or 3 pages talking about the Indian affinities and many of the ancient Egyptian remains. But he noted that, you know, but he stated that there's no genetic evidence for this to support this. So he said he's not really pushing that claim or whatever. But, you know, I mean, I see other things. But, you know, that the mysterious, you know, Lower Egyptian population, you know, that's the point of contention that I see a lot of non-black people kind of gravitating towards. And it's just like, you know, it's a desperate reach. You know, it's a desperate reach for multiple regions. Lower Egypt was inconsequential to the formation and maintenance of Egypt. And just, you know, the region was sparsely populated. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One other thing I wanted to touch on was the controversial DNA tribes. Now, we know that DNA tribes did their own analysis of the Egyptian population. Trey, do you know how that really looked as far as on the what they found?
So
DNA tribes did two studies on ancient Egyptian pharaohs, one on the Amarna period dynasty and one on the Ramesai dynasty. The Amarna period dynasties came at, samples came from Zahir Was when he conducted his 2010 study to find the family relationships of the Amarna period mummies. The SDR profiles were ran by DNA tribes and DNA consultant, and both found that these SDRs are most frequent in modern day central and southern and some West African populations. Just slipped my mind. My bad.
You are good.
Hold on.
They did. The highest affinity from what I'm seeing was that of the mostly the Southern African and African Great Lakes region, having the highest percentages when we're talking about Ramses the Third, Yoya, who else was it? Amenhotep the Third. They're taught. Southern Africa and African Great Lakes has always been at the highest point. Did you notice that too?
Yeah. King Tut and his family, the Amarna period, when coming out in 2012, the DNA that DNA tribe study. That study really found that the Southern African region was the closest, what had the closest affinities to that dynasty. The Southern African Bantu, possibly Khoisan. More likely Bantu, just based on, for multiple lines of evidence. We can get into it later, but I would argue it's more so Bantu because,
Well, go ahead and get into it.
Well, the Khoisan link, that's a highly, as mentioned, it's a highly divergent population. And we see some remnants of Bantu populations in modern Egyptian, particularly on the maternal side. With L02, I believe Ashton. Ashton knows that particular mark. Mm-hmm. But we don't really see, to my knowledge, we don't really see too many, hunter gatherer Khoisan markers in modern Egyptians at all to indicate that that was a population that had a longer habitation in Egypt or at least into dynastic Egypt. But, that's why I would argue that, it was more than likely the Bantu affinity that was, the closest match in those set of Africa. When it comes to the Great Lakes, that includes Nilo Saharans. That includes, Nilotic Africans. And with that, I argue you can go either way. Nilotic Africans, we know they've been in the Nile Valley civilization since the pre-dynastic period, particularly with the A-group Nubians. We see a close affinity between the two right there.
Between who?
With the A-group Nubians, we see a close affinity between themselves and the Egyptians.
Okay.
Nilotic Africans, and okay. All of them are tied because we know the A-group Nubians led to the formation of dynastic Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
But, that's why I wouldn't, like I said, when they match the Great Lakes, I think that's a toss up. That can be Bantu or Nilotic.
Yeah.
When DNA tribes did Ramses III, you saw a much, much larger West African component as well. As compared with the period with the Amarna period pharaohs. So I think that's something to look at. Also something to note as far as, the overall affinities of some of these people. There was a cranial analysis of these pharaohs in 1986, I believe, or 1982, through the X-ray atlas. Is conducted by Harris, and what they found was that both dynasties had, you know, close affinities to some modern East African groups and African Americans. But something that I found particularly interesting was with the Ramses, the Ramesside dynasty, which is Ramses III, is from the X-ray atlas, they found that his skeleton and his son's skeleton match Pliocene Nubians or early Holocene Nubians. Now, why is that interesting? My theory is these populations were somewhat ancestral to modern West Africans and whatnot. And I feel like, what we find in these early Holocene Nubians like Jebel Sahaba or late Pliocene, what we find in these Nubians as far as affinities is a strong West African affinity. Very, very strong West African affinity in these populations. And so when you also find that, you know, genetically, you know, you see a component that is, you know, most prevalent in populations in West Africa or, you know, the general Niger-Congo population, you know, I think that's something to note. You know, I don't think that's something to just overlook. You know, what's up, Ash?
Nothing. I was going to say something to consider. You know, I always leave all the options open and have, like, contingencies. If it's not this, then it's this. If it's not this, then it's this. One thing that you may want to consider about even Jebel Sahavin's and the remains in Somalia is that maybe, especially the one in southern Somalia, maybe that is like a Moda type person and not a Nilotic type person or West African type person. And I only say that because the DNA that they have, ancient DNA in Africa, even going back, I want to say, what do they have, an 18,000-year-old sample from Malawi? That whole corridor from Ethiopia going south into South Africa has like a Moda type signature, an aboriginal type signature that spread south. I'm going to presume maybe it spread north as well. I don't see a reason why not. And, you know, maybe that's what we're looking at in the north. And I only say that because there was a study that came out that basically said, you know, looking at all the ancestry in the Horn of Africa, the oldest one is like Omotic, and then this, and then that, and then this, and then these guys. It's like all these layers. Of course, with Omotic or Moda being the oldest one. So maybe that's what that sample is.
Didn't they note that some of these early Southeast African skeletons were quote unquote non-Negroid? Didn't they? Or at least that's what some of the East Africans,
They did.
Like Cushy always notes that a lot of those samples that you noted, they don't have Negroid affinities. So,
in some ways, maybe they should. It depends on where their ancestors are coming from, right? And so I think, I don't know. They should look. They're coming from this part of Africa, or are they coming from here? They should look that way. And they travel south, and you're seeing, you know, their skeletons. I don't think that means anything, though.
One thing we talked about last week with the Land of Punt was that evidence shows that the Khoisan people used to dominate, you know, not just the Great Lakes region, not just Southeast Africa, but, you know, they went well into the Nile Valley. We know that with Nasser Kader.
That's right.
Let me throw a curveball at you.
Moda ancestry is basically the same as Hadza ancestry.
Yeah.
And Hadza are Khoisan. They're Eastern Khoisan. They are.
On the Tishka now, the dead?
Yeah, they are.
You said Moda.
Linguistically, Hadza are Khoisan. Hadza. Hadza, like if you want to spin it that way, that ancestry is kind of the same. So it's Moda, but it's also Hadza, and Hadza are Khoisan. But they're an East African Khoisan.
I think they diverged a lot. Well, I think they diverged a lot later than
a lot later.
And the reason why I say that, well, I mean, we've all seen the Tishkoff tree. You know, the three oldest populations in Africa are the Khoisan, Pygmies, and Niger Congo, followed by the Hausa.
I'll give you that, but the Niger Congo speakers have certain types of ancestry that's older that sort of puts them in that position, right? So you have, which study was it? It was one of the studies where it basically showed how, you know, West Africans are in the position that they're in because a portion of their ancestry is extremely, extremely old West African ancestry that diverged around the same time as Khoisan. And then another chunk of the West African ancestry is actually a more recent East African migration. So those are your E1B1A. E1B1A is not a native lineage of that region. A00A is. So they have that old A00 ancestry that's making them old, but then they have the new E1B1A from the Nile Valley, as you argue, that's making them newer. So the Niger Congo part, they're not old because of the Niger Congo. They're old because of that old AOO people that no longer exist. If that makes sense.
Yeah, because we know, for example, we know the EM2 marker is relatively recent. So there is an older component in Niger Congo that has to be accounted for.
A00, A1A, A01.
Or E1B1.
E1A. Yeah. B2A.
Now, E1A is in the Mende people, right? In Dogon.
It's in, yeah, that's concentrated. Dogon.
That's weird. Just very strange.
It's kind of weird.
So let me ask, because remember in Tishkoff 2009, the Dogon had that non-African component nobody could explain. So-called non-African component.
Bruh. So they did say the samples may have contamination, right? They did say that. But then the non-African component wasn't necessarily non-African. It was also seen as Saharan. So,
I don't think, the whole differentiation between African and Saharan, that study, I mean, it was good for its time, but what they call non-African was really, like you said, what they call non-African was really African, even in North Africa, with the Mozambique sample, or whatever the M sample was in the North. Remember that sample, you know, I remember you was teasing the people on the racist Arabs on foreign biodiversity, because you were basically saying that North Africans were horners mixed with later coming populations. But recently we found that, you know, North African components, you know, have come into existence within the last 1,000 years or so. So, you know, that very well too could be, you know, an indigenous component to Africa, you know, as a result of, you know, admixture and whatnot, but, you know, it still originated in Africa, you know.
Yeah, you're right. It likely is. It likely is. But the thing that conflicts with Tishkoff is Dogon are actually one of the most West African of all West African samples. Dogon and people in Burkina Faso. So, you know, that's the conflicting with Tishkoff's data.
Right.
I got a break for dinner. I'm going to move to the audience. Man.
Cool. Come back when you get done, man. Don't get the itis. But I wanted to get with Ashton on this, but one thing that I saw Imhotep points out is that linguistically, how Greenberg said that all these coastal West African groups are closely related, that's not true. Linguistically, that's not true. And, you know, I look at the context as to why that's not true, because they all come from a migration to which none of that, you know, implies that they're closely related, because they settled in an area in close proximity to one another. You know, that's a hell of an assumption by, you know, European scholars, you know, that they've always been there and they evolved in that region. But genetically as well, I see that some genetic tests do that as well, where they'll group, for example, Benin and Togo, all those groups together and all that, and say, well, that's one component. The thing is, who's to say that they are closely related just because they've been geographic neighbors for the last 600-700 years? Who's to say they're really genetically closely related, you know? But
yeah,
that's a little besides the point or whatever. That's something Ashton to get into when he gets back. But as far as the Egyptians and shit, there have not been any studying modern Egyptians to the ancient Egyptians as a primary group. Not one,
no,
to this day. Not a single study. Abu Sair, they cite that, but like Bodhi mentioned earlier, that study shows that Neolithic Turks are the closest people to the ancient Egyptians. And
You're spoiling.
Yeah.
Nah, but we know that. But we are gonna break that down in much more detail, the Abu Sair study. Because again, if anybody in here is familiar with the Abu Sair study, they know that the Egyptians love to reference that, and we are gonna be breaking that down because it's not what they try to make it out to be.
Yeah, real quickly, I want to address this. This Asar Emo, whatever his name is, this Asar Emotep.
Yes.
He had a conversation with the linguist. And I just want everyone to know, like, how it went. This is Abadeli Kambone. This is a PhD in linguistics as of 2012, a decade. Here we go.
All in linguistics and all, for example, then, with a lot, are you a physicist? Do you study physics? Okay. Have you studied linguistics formally?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Now, both is lies.
Just a second.
Yeah, I'm gonna let Bodhi gather his information on that to make his point on that, but I did want to make a reference to Soy Kida one more time, because he also broke it down. If anybody wanted to think differently on this population, he said that the ancient Egyptians or their ancestors came primarily from outside of Africa and showed no biological relationship with even more southerly Africans. Now, he was out to disprove this. This was a misconception. He did a series of misconceptions. This was number 4. And the fact of the matter is that he said that the anthropological evidence and studies showed that indicate that the ancient Egyptians had more tropical affinities with Nubians and even more southerly Africans during the even during the late dynastic Delta Egyptians as well. And that's what he concluded. So when we're talking about these, this series of Egyptians, again, we're talking mostly Upper Egypt, which will be technically Southern, but he's also making a note that Lower Egypt as well was concentrated with Nubian, and they use that loosely. I want people to understand that when they say Nubian, they're talking about just Black people in general, really. You can't find a people and their cranial analysis or their genetics based on their ethnicity. So when they say that, they're just broadly saying Black people. And we know that, even if I went into the discussion about, I brought up a few days ago about there was a pharaoh in the Delta during the 26th dynasty. His name was Amyris the Nubian, they called him. So if we look at, if anybody wanted to Google Amyris the Nubian, he was part of the 26th dynasty. And he ruled during the Kushite dynasty as well, because the Kushites, they were ruling primarily Lower Egypt. Upper Egypt. And Lower Egypt, they did pull some affinities or some locations, but he left most of that to Amyris. And I think that's greatly, that should be greatly noted and appreciated as well. So when soy cheetah does come down, people need to understand the thorough analysis in which he brings, especially on a biological front. Wouldn't that be correct?
Yeah, his evidence is, hold on one second.
His evidence is, again, one of the only scholars from Cambridge University who really delves into the genetic portion of it. He talks about haplotypes. He says haplotypes. But most of it is going to be talking about this cultural link, linguistic link, this anthropological link as well, when we're studying the relatives or what have you, cranial analysis as well. So there's going to be different categories and breaks that down, but soy cheetah does a good job in genetics too.
He's the leading geneticist, and you know, as far as ancient Egypt is concerned, that's why National Geographic, you know, consults him and shit. But for whatever reason, well, we know the reason why, but you know, people are trying to, you know, override genetic evidence and say, well, genetics doesn't tell you, no, they're trying to override physical evidence. I said, well, bones doesn't tell you much. And it's like,
he's a leader, and that's the funny part, because he's a leader in the cranial analysis as well.
Right, exactly. Right, and that's what
should align. Obviously, they both should have some sort of alignment, and even if bones can't tell you, right, like they can't tell you, hey, we can't differentiate between this tropical population and another tropical population, you can still establish through morphology whether a population's recent ancestors came from a tropical, a subtropical, or like a Mediterranean region. And you can still establish phylogenetic relationships using morphology. And so these people are just saying they don't believe in physical anthropology. And fine, go ahead and say that. I know, but that would automatically make you pseudo, in the same way that someone saying, I don't believe in genetics, would make them pseudo. Right? If you want to, you know, take that position, you can.
It's a fundamental disingenuous nature and bad faith argument on their part, because the ultimate question is, what race were the Egyptians? That is the ultimate question behind all this shit. And when you get to it, you say, well, with all your genetic talk, are you going to make the argument that genetics equates to race? Are you going to make the argument that a particular genotype is going to be expressed phenotypically? Are you going to stand on that argument? If you're not, then let's talk about race. When we talk about race, we're talking about your physical character, your external anatomical features. That is your bone. That's your structure. It's what you look like. It's what society, it's what Jim Crow laws were based on. You know, it's what, you know, the genocide of the Tasmanians and whatnot was based on. It's based on what you look like. It's not based on your genotype. So there's a fundamental disingenuous nature when they try to diverge into these, you know, genotype arguments, because they're trying to answer a question about race, you know, and there's no possible way you can determine a person's race through their genotype. There's no possible way you can do that. You know, but when we talk to these people, you know, they will, you know, keep on with this whole thing. Well, we can, for example, I can bring up a study from 2008 by a guy named Gade or whatever, G-O-D-D-E, where he's done a couple of studies where he analyzed, you know, the relationship between Egyptians and Nubians. And of course, he always finds there's a deep overlap between, you know, various, you know, early Egyptian and Nubian populations. And he also finds that, you know, there's a distinction between, you know, them and later Egyptians. You know, later Egyptians and later Nubians always group far away from, you know, the early samples. And that's, you know, routinely found. It's been found since, you know, the 1800s. But, you know, what does that imply? You know, that's what they don't want to acknowledge. You know, that is the disingenuous nature of this whole argument. What does this highly divergent, you know, later Egyptian population, what does this implication mean about you?
Well, I mean, so earlier you mentioned that there was no study that showed that there was genetic continuity between modern and ancient Egyptians. There is, why is the word Hausdorff? It's Hildeman's study, the study that we often cite to say that, you know, Copts and Egyptians are about 70% Eurasian. That study argues that there was genetic continuity between the modern and the ancient populations, just that the modern population is admixed. You can also look at Pagini's study, also sort of implies that there's genetic continuity. Just means that there wasn't a genocide and a complete population replacement.
I think, or conversely, it could mean that you've maintained a patch of genetic ancestry on top of a wave of other
shit. Correct. Yeah.
So that being said, if these people maintain 10 or 20% of their original ancestry, which we see the Negroness in Egyptians in the Arab world, Egyptians are very much Negroid in appearance, very much, even the Northern.
Well, then you lose. So when you argue like there's no genetic continuity, right? You kind of lose your credibility for no reason.
Well,
you already agree that there is.
Hold on. No, what I'm saying is these people are mixed, despite some Negroid physical traits, they're mixed. But we see, for example, it's a dude who I was talking to about a month ago on Twitter. He's an Egyptian dude. This dude has wide nostrils. Like he has Congolese nostrils. And he looks like a Dominican. And I'm sitting here looking at him like, but he claims he's Arab and everything. But dude, clearly you have some African component in you. Clearly you do. But with your other admixture, you might not be the best representative of what that original component looked like. You know, that's what Keita said. He said, yeah, there's been continuity between the ancient and the modern, but all this admixture, I mean, you can't possibly look at these modern people and say, this is what the ancient ones look like. You can't possibly do that.
But that's what you're arguing. And you're not arguing that there was a genocide or a complete
replacement.
Just accept the genetic continuity, right? And then, even when you accept genetic continuity, also, like, yeah, there were people who are Greek and Roman settling in Alexandria and Fayum. You know, there are Turkish people who came along. Certainly Arabs came along. There are people who don't have genetic continuity with ancient Egyptians because they literally are people who invaded Egypt and they still live there. Right.
Right.
So mixture
with them. Okay. From a physiological standpoint, as far as, you know, craniometrically, no, these people do not group with the Egyptians as a whole. Modern Egyptians do not. What I'm saying is, despite the fact that y'all are not the best match for the Egyptians, I can still see that y'all are a little more Negroid than your Arab neighbors to the east. I can still see that. And other people have noted that. But, you know, that's neither here nor there.
I mean, I think it's also important to note what scholars are saying as well. If you look at Arthur Goldschmidt, in the A Brief History of Egypt, he also talked about the passage of time of people assimilating into the Egyptian culture, the Egyptian area. With the passage of time, each wave of new immigrants has assimilated into the local mix of peoples, making modern Egypt a combination of Libyans, Nubians, Syrians, Persians, Macedonians, Romans, Arabs, Turks, Caucasians, Greeks, Italians, and Armenians, along with the descendants of the original ancient Egyptian people. Also, in the Oxford Encyclopedia of Africa, Volume 1, that came out in 2010, said that one cannot say that today's Egypt is the same as the Egypt of antiquity, any more than one can say that today's North America is the same as it was 5,000 years ago. Asim, did you have something to note as well?
I don't think we should, you know, rule out when you say the ancient people aren't the same as the modern. I don't think we should rule out the diversity that is there, right? Because you have people that do look very similar to the ancients. You just have to go to certain areas to find them. You know, some of them look more like the ancients, and then some of them look less. But to say they don't exist, I don't think that's quite true. Even if you want to argue there were Nubians, there's still Nubians in Egypt. If you want to argue they were like Ethiopians, there's still Cushitic people in Egypt.
Yeah, I want to say this. Now,
as far as that is concerned, as far as the components, you know,
Matrix.
Hold on, Trey, repeat that. You starting you in the Matrix.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, like, my thing as far as the whole
hold on, you know, hold on, you're breaking up again.
Okay. Let me get with y'all in like 5 minutes or so. I'm about to do something real quick. Ashton, you just go ahead and flow until I get back to it.
You know, I was going to say, you know, in my opinion, it's a better argument to make, talk about the continuity and then try to figure out, you know, what's new and what's old. I'm of the opinion that we don't have the genetic tools to even know how much of their ancestry is recent and how much is not. Ancient Egypt was like a freaking super kingdom, and they dominated all these other different groups. So when they colonized the Levant and set up shop there for hundreds of years, Levantines have Egyptian ancestry. So you have a migration of a people that are partly Egyptian migrating back into Africa. Yeah, they're bringing some Eurasian with them, but they're also bringing back African ancestry. It'd be like me moving back to Nigeria, you know, or Obama moving back to Kenya. He's half African, so he's not coming back as a full white person. And, you know, some of the arguments we make are, you know, they lose a lot because we keep them simple. And it's not simple. It's not simple at all.
I mean, my thing is this, though. Hey, can y'all hear me?
Yeah.
So my thing is this, as far as continuity is concerned, having elements of the original does not make you the original. That being said, what element? Well, I guess, you know, that would be, you know, the question we're all asking, but.
The original don't exist. Think about this. We're running y'all some numbers. Everybody was talking about DNA tribes and this and that, and how they match with Central Africans and blah, blah, blah. When you look at the DNA tribes and you look at the MLI scores, right? The MLI scores show you the maximum likelihood that this profile is found anywhere on Earth. So the King Tut, if his MLI score to South Africa is 300, that means his genome is 300 more times likely to be found in South Africa than any place around the planet. Now, I've taken a DNA tribes test, and other African-Americans that take DNA tribes tests and Africans that take DNA tribes tests. Matter of fact, anybody that take DNA tribes tests, the MLI scores are in the millions. So my score, I wish I had the information. I want to say my MLI with West Africa was like, it could have been 3 million or 6 million or something like that.
Yeah,
and so you have these mummies matching with parts of Africa where it's matching at like 6 and 12 and 30 and 90 and 300. So that's like minuscule
compared to
a modern person matching. And to make matters worse, some of these mummies matched at 10, 20, and 30 and 50, but a European will match in Africa as 1,000. So what that means is they extinct. The genome, as you know it, is extinct. It's been too much mixing.
No, they only had 8 SDRs. They only had 8 SDRs at the rim. If they had 13, then, you know, it would have been 1,000. It's 88.
You breaking up.
Hold on, you're breaking up, Trey.
Can you hear me?
Where are you at? You in the house?
I'm waiting on my partner. y'all can't hear me now? Yeah, so yeah,
we can hear you.
All right. Yeah, so there were only 8 SDR profiles out of 13. I guarantee if they'd had a 13, then yeah, it would be in the millions. But the fact is ADNA, they probably couldn't get all that.
Yeah.
And no, but no. Because when you do DNA tribes, it's the same thing for all of us. It's the STR limited thing.
No, but I mean, but it's more than 8 for us. You know, that's the thing. You know, that was the thing for that's the main thing they use to discredit that one thing. Oh, well, it's just eight. You can't possibly. But the thing they're not talking about is that if you would. What the 8 did was narrow it down to the regions. If you'd have added more, it'd have just went down to a tribe and a family. So it's within that region. So it's like, I mean, what are y'all trying to say? I mean, more of them just would have been more horror for you. They would have identified the tribe. That would have been worse for you, you know? And if it was more, it would have been in the mid. The matches would have been the millions if it was the 13 pairs. But it wasn't. It was just 8. You know? But, you know,
like I don't said, buy it.
Yeah, man, like I said, man, if they'd had the full 13 instead of the 8, you know, it'd have been the match would have been the millions and it would have been more.
No, because it's vague, the match is wider. You actually have more people. Increasing the resolution would actually, no, increasing the resolution would narrow it down.
Right.
Right. So what you're saying is backwards.
That would have made the matches higher. That would have.
No, it wouldn't have made the matches higher. It would have made the likelihood a lot more distinct.
I don't know.
Yes. It's just like with the Y chromosome STR. When you keep it vague, you got matches all over the place. But the more you add, it narrows down until you got 34 or 68 STRs. It's like, oh, you can only be E1B1A. That's what would have happened. That genome is extinct.
I don't think so, man. I think that if they would have had the full 13, that it would have went straight to, you know, the West African or Central or Southern African populations.
But they not just Central and Southern African. What the STR score is doing is basically saying that this specific mix of people, wet Saharans, riverine hunter-gatherers, ancient Nubians, the tiny bit of Levantine, the proto-East African, all those people that sort of melded together to create an Egyptian genome 4,000 years ago, that specific mix doesn't exist anywhere else. It's like super-duper rare. It's like us. You would have to mix us like at these exact proportions, at these exact times to make it happen again. That's why we distinct from Jamaicans, or we distinct from, you know, Haitians.
I think if it had been, you know, 10 rather than the 8, then it would have been a perfect match.
Nah.
So it would have.
Why?
Would have.
West Africans don't even match to South Africans. Why would it match to a South African? The South African Bantu wasn't even in South Africa during the time of King Tut. So it's what's the word? Anachronistic.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, African persons together. They say East, Central, Southern, all that stuff. Relate, North Sahelian, all that stuff is in the database. So they all see that they have a genetic distinction despite having some similarities and shit, but
okay, but South African Bantu don't have that mix. What mix of South African Bantu people that are like partly Cushitic, partly Nilotic, partly West African, and partly South African? Who would that be? And partly Sahelian. Like, who is that?
And just, okay, it's just like the Great Lakes Bantu is damn largely Nilotic, you know, but that's still, Well, as far as their admixture, you know.
But they don't have South African ancestry, though.
Right, that's right.
Okay, I'm going to agree to disagree.
I see.
I agree to disagree.
Y'all agree to disagree. What about the topic of hair? You know, a lot of people have a debate about that. When you look at Queen T.A. or Ramsey's having, they call him the ginger head and things of that nature. Does a more softer or loosely curled hair make a people non-African?
It's only one right answer.
What's up, Aston? What is it?
Well, okay, it's best to look at hair from an evolutionary standpoint, right? Yeah, and sure. You have to ask, why is a person's hair straight? Why is a person's hair curly? And when you do that and you look at the research, you find out a few things. There was one researcher, I bring her up often, her name was Tina Lasisi. Over the pandemic, she defended her thesis that curly hair is an adaptation to hot and moist environments. It basically cools the brain. And she did all these tests and made all this new ways of measuring hair, and her whole doctorate is on hair, specifically Black people's hair. And so you have that. And if Northern Africa is hot, but it's not moist, in fact, it's really, really, really arid, then why would we expect for those people to have tightly curled hair? Number one. Number two, they found that curly hair is actually a derived trait, which means it is not ancestral, which means the earliest humans had straight hair.
Yeah.
And so the theory is, you know, our earliest non-human ancestors, like apes and stuff, as you see chimpanzees and monkeys and whatever, they have straight hair. And our ancient ancestors had straight hair. And then the earliest humans had straight hair. And then when they migrated into a hot, moist place, that's when the genetic change happened and you get the derived trait for curly hair. So considering the oldest humans had straight hair, they preserved straighter hair. Some of them, it's going to be a mix because you have people that adapted to a different climate coming in to mix. But we shouldn't expect them, you know, living in the climate that they live in, to have really, really tightly coiled hair if they've been living there for tens and tens of thousands of years.
But we know that they wasn't.
So that's the answer.
But the reason why we know that they wasn't there for tens and tens of thousands of years is because Egypt is in the subtropics. And we know that the ancient Egyptians were what? Tropically adapted. So they came.
Yeah, but the tropics, hold on. The tropics does not mean moist. Remember, most of the time, Africa, you talk about savannah. Savannah is dry.
But south of Egypt in the tropics, you know, most of that region is either like Sahel, Savannah, but they're...
That's dry, though. That's not moist. It's not moist like the forest belt.
Let's look at this real quick. All right, let me pull up a map of your dig of Africa. You can look at...
To be clear, you're on the topic of hair now, right? Right, Trey?
We're talking about hair.
Just... Nah, he just kind of offset on that, so I just want to kind of look at it real quick.
No, I changed the topic because you were in the Matrix. I wanted to make sure you were still on the topic of the hair, and then we could go back to what you were talking about.
Okay,
but if you don't have anything to add to it, I'll, yeah, we hear you.
All right.
We on a topic of hair, why Queen T.A. may have a more looser curl, or Ramses being known as the ginger head and things like that nature. The topic is hair and the biological affinity of hair in Africa.
And I'll add, in that part of the world, when you go there, you go to southern Egypt, you go to Nubia, you go to Central Sudan, you go to the Horn of Africa, people pitch black and they got straight hair.
Yeah.
You know, they black as fuck and they have straight hair. There isn't a correlation with skin color and hair morphology.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And you'll see that in Chadwick. Go ahead.
My bad. But, like, I think one thing that, like, a lot of people ain't really, like, kind of taking into consideration is, like, when we talk about Egypt, we know it was diverse. We know it was black people from, you know, all type of hair, you know, wide nostril, thin nose, thin lip. We already know that. We see that. But something like a lot of people ain't talking about is some groups kind of dominated over other groups. And what we kind of find, you know, from a anthropological and a genetic standpoint is we see that a lot of the royal and higher officials, they tend to have more affinities with people like us. We found the sickle cell in nobles in pre-dynastic Egypt, not in peasants. We found E1B1A, that's our marker. We found that in Ramses III, that's a pharaoh. We find Negroid morphologies, you know, in, you know, pharaonic dynasties. You know, whereas the general population, you might find people who look East African or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is diverse, but I did want to talk about this topic because, you know, opposing arguments do want to point that out a lot more often. I want to throw something out there as well, which really isn't in any type of study or anything like that, but this is just more of an anecdotal observation. We do know that when it comes to Black or African type of hair types, when your hair is wrapped up, and we know that the Egyptians use a lot of chemicals as well. So when we're talking about chemicals being involved, they use a lot of hennas, which would account for Ramses having red hair and some of these other Egyptians in some cases. When we're talking about chemicals and having your hair wrapped up in a very hot and heated, situation there, what happens? Your hair starts to get straighter and it starts to loosen the coils of the on the hair follicles. Now, I bring that up because also they found, like I said, TA with looser curled hair. But also when you look into the army of Menhotep, they found a gravesite for his army and they were not, wrapped the best. And when their hair wasn't, when they seen that they weren't wrapped so neatly and tightly, their hair stayed intact. They had the same coiled hair that you would have seen in this other known Nubian that they found as well. I'm forgetting his name off top. I did want to speak to the paper.
You talking about Mianfri?
Is it?
It's not ringing a bell.
It could be.
That's the one.
Yeah, Mianfri, okay. The one from the Book of the Dead, yeah.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I also wanted to point out a paper that that was in Swakita's dissertation, I believe it was. He says, defining a population as a narrow type logically leads to a procedure of such as picking out individuals with a given external phenotype and seeing them as members of a pure race whose members all had the same characteristics. This would imply that a blonde in the family of brunettes was somehow more related to other blondes than immediate family members, which means it wouldn't really make much of a sense. Also, he pointed out a guy named Strahl microscopically examined some hair which had been preserved on a Badarian skull. The analysis was interpreted as suggesting a stereotypical tropical African European hybrid, or what he said, mulatto. However, this hair is grossly no different from that of the Fulani, some Kanuri, or Somali, and does not require a gene flow explanation any more than curly hair in Greece necessarily does. Extremely woolly hair is not the only kind of native tropical African type. So he really wanted to break that down in a sense of how we understand this and how other people have perceived African people, Black peoples, and their hair types.
Can I piggyback?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is why you can't use the outdated race models that white people use, because they made up those race models, and those race models are bogus. And if you try to, you know, match them on that, you will lose, because there's all types of reasons, microadaptation reasons why a person looks a certain way. And, you know, the race model that they use say, oh, no, you looked a certain way because you have this specific ancestry, and that's wrong. So, you know, I kind of cringe when I see people say, oh, these people that's there now, they it is because look at their hair. And when you have actual
genetic data that shows straight hair is the original hair of Homo sapien. Then you have fossil data that talk about some of the oldest Homo sapiens come out of North Africa. So, you know, people in these race models just get it all twisted. It doesn't work to their advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was one of the topics that needed to be explained and touched on, because we do tend to look at a current population as what was 5,000 years ago. And so, yeah, we kind of muddy the waters with that every now and then. So to bring that to the forefront would be a major key in discussion here. I think we pretty much wrapped up discussion, unless anybody wanted to add any last minute notes.
I'm good.
Absolutely. So yes, I do thank y'all for coming in. This was the straight facts portion. We are going to be transitioning to rapid fire. So anybody that had any questions or what have you, you are invited to come in and do so. And you can check us out. More discussions will be right here in these spaces, or even check out rockorus.com and podcast. Thank you. All right. So we're back. Oh, we're signing off, Bodhi. Unless you had something else to add.
Oh yeah, I just wanted to finish the clip of a Asar emo tab. I don't know what happened.
I want you to just land there, nigga.
That is an incorrect and it's not a very good order of operations. So you're going to.
I don't see a reconstruction of Yoruba in your work or a card.
How would I reconstruct your body that's spoken right now? How does that make any sense to you?
Because that's my point.
Anyways, I just wanted to get that out with the FPA tree. I don't know. We can have this conversation later about ancient Egyptian linguistics and all of that, but Asar Imhotep is such a fraud.
Him debating somebody makes him a fraud? I'm not sure what the point of that was.
Linguist. And he told the linguist, hey, I study linguistics. And he asked the linguist why he had not reconstructed a language that is spoken right now in Nigeria.
This is
who you choose to follow.
The thing about it is, brother, he has PhDs on his page every month. You know, he has a Yoruba PhD on there, I posted his video a couple months ago. You know, he's on the same train as Asar. So he's a PhD and he actually studies Yoruba. You know, let me post a dude, you know. So I guess they're all Soto. Then you just have to put a PhD as the reason why Asar was wrong. Well, another PhD agrees with him.
Now, right? I don't understand, does having a PhD mean that, whenever you speak to someone, you now sort of give a rubber stamp on their views or something? I don't understand what's being said here. I didn't say he didn't meet with PhDs. The guy who he's speaking to right now, Abed Amban, is a PhD. I know he speaks to PhDs. I know that. I'm saying he had an encounter with the PhD. Okay. And honestly, you don't even need to be a PhD to see how stupid that comment was from Asar Imhotep, right? But if you weren't a PhD, Asar Imhotep would be like, well, you don't know anything about linguistics, so I can't listen to you, right? That's the same thing he says about Christopher Ehret and Greenberg. So when it comes up against a PhD, I didn't play the PhD, going into depth about Asar Imhotep's lack of knowledge. I didn't do that. I'm better than that, right? But sure. that's what happened. You know, that's essentially what happened. So I don't know why you're so fond of this man.
Bodhi's feelings is really hurt after Asar Imhotep just stomped him into the ground when he called 2 months ago. It was hilarious. It was a classic, you know, mash of teacher schooling. Bodhi's very scorned about that. Very, very scorned. As far as PhDs, you would have wondered about a PhD. You said, well, he's arguing with a PhD and a PhD. Well, okay, well, I'll post another PhD and he agrees with him. So, you know, you would have wondered about a PhD, not me.
Yeah, I'm just, again, so the reason why I mentioned that he was a PhD, because Asar Imhotep sort of tries to use that against, like, people like Christopher Aaron, right?
No, he doesn't. When did he say that?
No degree.
Hold on. When did he use that against
Aaron? Recognition at all.
Don't lie, Bodie. See, he's lying. See, so you said that he uses that against Efren and Green. No, he doesn't. He mentioned that they do not have linguistic degrees. He mentioned that. He mentioned that the Greenberg...
Give himself credibility, because he also doesn't have a linguistic degree.
Okay. Right?
But he's not a Christopher Eric. He's not a Greenberg.
Dude, he's a PhD.
PhD. He's never claimed to have a PhD. What are you talking
he's
about?
Working, he's in school right now.
Does he have a PhD or not?
Dude, when he was debating you, he was literally debating
does
you.
Does he
from
have
his
a PhD or not?
No.
So does he have a PhD?
He's working on it, Bodie.
Okay.
He ain't got one then.
He was literally debating you from his school, and you're asking, so what's his scholastic credibility? Dude, come on, bro. Don't do that. But anyway, yeah, he never discredited Efren or Greenberg for not having a PhD. What he said is that people come to him and say, oh, you're not a linguist. How can you say that? And he says, well, the whole basis of your linguistic theories come from a guy who did not have a degree in linguistics. So, you know, what are you trying to say? What are you trying to say? You need a linguistic degree to be valid? No, you don't. You don't. The Greenbergian theory is Afro-Asiatic, the Bantu migration from Cameroon. That's a guy who did not have a degree in linguistics. But that's who we get all these theories from. And if you go against it, you're Soto. You're all that goofy shit.
Find full episodes of the podcast featuring Straight Facts on Spotify, Apple Music, and soon on YouTube. Also, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/MorocOris for all your favorite rapid fire discussions, and stay tuned for more. Peace, Mur. I'm on Ra.